A number of years ago, well before I actually entered the rabbinate here, I think probably well before I think the year before I entered the Fifth Avenue Synagogue, so I was invited to speak on Tisha B'Av in Queens, in Forest Hills, Rabbi Al-Ghazi's shul as part of their programming. And so I asked him, so the person who invited me was a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, who was also a professor at YU, Professor Rabbi Dr. Joel Hachman, Zichrono Levracha, taught accounting. We also went for smicha, so I never took accounting, but I did. He sat next to me in all my smicha classes, so we became friends through the years. And then my older brother says to me, "You're friends with Hachman? He's the hardest professor in YU from his perspective." So I remember asking Professor Hachman, who was a very straight, honest person, I said, like, what am I supposed to talk about? He says, "I don't know. Talk about teach Torah, it's Tisha B'Av." I said, "But I'm speaking after like 9 other people that you organized for the day. How many different versions of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa do you want?" So he sends me the schedule, just to see before I select the title. And he says, you know, I'm looking at some of these titles and I'm thinking to myself, wow, these look enjoyable. They also look like they're about to really violate a lot of the laws of Tisha B'Av, not to accuse anybody. And I think I was wrong in the end, but I realized that for myself, Tisha B'Av as a day of learning, on the one hand, is a mandatory experience, and on the other hand, is something that requires us to see things a little bit differently. So I'm going to walk the gauntlet over here between creating a situation of enjoyment and creating an enjoyment within something that's allowed. I was at the earlier mincha before, and after mincha, this was a long conversation. I had to stop it after a couple of minutes. I told the guys, like, "You're treading a little bit close into areas of halacha that we're not supposed to be spending time on with depth." And there was like a back and a forth, people arguing with logic. And so I said, "Guys, it's too much fun." And so a couple of years ago, I developed this series by accident, based off the fact that I like people. People, places, and things has been one of my, things for a very long time. To study some of the profiles in exile. And, you know, when we talk about Galus, there are so many different personalities. There's the Rabbi Tzadok that we talked about 1 year because he was the one who, we gave one-third of the requests. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was a doctor for Rabbi Tzadok. He must have been an important person. Who was he and what do we know about him? And we talked about Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkalus, the man who kind of offered the advice that created the end of the B'Kamsa Bar Kamsa story, and what was he thinking? Last year we moved a little bit further because, you know, as we highlighted in both of our sessions of Kinos this morning, Tisha B'Av is a day of reflection, recognition, and sort of identification for us. And it's a day that causes all of us to think, because the story of Jewish history, certainly since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, has certainly been a story of challenge and exile. So last year, I waxed almost Sephardic, and we talked a lot about the Abarbanel, and we understood through the Abarbanel's life, we developed an understanding of what it means not to have a certain sense of permanence, and how a person has to struggle sometimes in order to accomplish, even when you have no permanent home, it's not so easy to sit and to learn. So today I want to help us understand the perspective of a life under persecution. And that life under persecution from beginning to middle to end, and some of the lessons we take away, and maybe some of the reflection that we have as we wane our way through the end of Tisha B'Av, I want to spend some time focusing on somebody who had to find Yerushalayim all the way out in Germany. Now, as I pointed out this morning, you have to be very careful when you make a statement like that. I'm in Elizabeth. Elizabeth, of course, finds its roots where? Marvin, Divinsk, right? And the Holy Rameir Simcha of Divinsk, the author of the Meshech Chachma, who knew of Pinchas Tayitz as a cute little boy who carried travelers to him. So he writes in probably his most famous comment to Parshas Bechukosai that a Jew has a responsibility to make sure that he doesn't confuse Divinsk and Berlin. And when a Jew walks around thinking, Berlin, Zeu Yerushalayim, Ochen Vei, that's a bad thing for us. That's not my intent today at all. Nor do I think that that is what we'll walk away with when we start to analyze the quite tragic life and experience of Rameir of Rittenberg. So let's roll up our sleeves. Let's first identify him. Reb Meir Baruch of Rutenberg was one of the greatest authorities who lived in the second half of the 13th century in Europe, and certainly in Germany. He was a very, very important personality. We're going to discover by the time we're done that Ashkenazic Jews, again, we're talking about Germany primarily, Ashkenazic Jews would not really know what to do in their lives if not for the Maharam of Rutenberg, Maharam or Meir, right? They wouldn't know what to do with them themselves. But his story begins a lot earlier. His story begins somewhere between 1215 and 1222. There's a discussion among historians as to exactly when he was born. And the Maharam of Rutenberg seems to be born into a very, very illustrious family. Certainly, he identifies in a lot of his tshuvas, in a lot of his writings, his chidushim, his uncle, his cousin, everyone's called Mori, my teacher. So he wasn't just living in modern times where he was just, you know, trying to use proper etiquette. He actually believed that these people were special people. In particular, he was quite fond of his father, Reb Baruch. Reb Baruch was certainly part of a major community. He was a dayan. He was a rabbinic court judge in the city of Vermeisa, Worms. And that's important to us. Why? Because one of the major Orthodox Jewish communities in Germany, and certainly in Western Europe, was the community of Worms. Somebody else whom we know quite well lived in Worms for a period of time. Very good, Lenny. Rashi is certainly identified as having spent time in Worms, in Vermeisa. Joel Javitt and I were going back and forth because Joel was a little disappointed with a comment that appears in the Seder Adoros, but it does appear there. In fact, the last commentaries in the Seder Adoros, which is a historical work, talk about the destruction of the city of Vermeisa. That's it. That's the end of the work, primarily. Vermeisa says the Seder Adoros was destroyed in the opinion of the Seder Adoros because this community found itself founded at what point in time? After which Churban Marvin? No, it was founded, according to the Seder Adoros, it was founded after the Churban Bayis Rishon. And the problem was that when the Binyan Bayis Sheni, when the Second Temple was being organized 70 years later, they sent messages all over to Jewish communities everywhere. And so they went to the people in Vermeisa and they said, "Hey guys, come along for the ride. We're rebuilding Israel. And not only are we going to rebuild Israel, we're going to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash." You know what happened to the community of Vermeisa? They said, "You do your thing there, we'll do our thing here." And so the author of the Seder Adoros turns around and says, when you turn around and you say, "You're there, I'm here," Churban comes to you. And in particular, we're going to see that the community of Worms, of Vermeisa, suffers tremendously in the process. In the meantime, Reb Baruch becomes one of the members of the rabbinate, and he's quite well respected. He seems to be a very good friend of one of the Balei HaTosfos, the Ravia, whose name is certainly one that we've heard before in our learning sessions. The Ravia, a very important one of the Balei HaTosfos. And the Maharam himself says he learned under Rav Yitzchak Or Zeruah. The Or Zeruah was also a famed Tosfos, one of the earliest people to compile halachos, to figure out how to learn halach l'maisa. You're living at a time where you have no Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is not going to be written for a number of generations. You're living at a period in time we don't have a Torah, and the Rambam ain't too popular yet. So how do people figure out halacha? They have to learn. And yet here's this young kid, the Maharam, somewhere in his teens, early 20s, and he's got to be learning from his Rebbe, the Reb Yitzchak Or Zeruah, and we find that he actually argues with him from time to time. And we find that the Or Zeruah didn't kick him out of yeshiva. So the Maharam himself must have been some sort of identified prodigy. He loved the Or Zeruah. And somewhere up until the year 1225, he identifies with still being in Germany and still learning from the Or Zeruah. Somewhere between 1225 and 1240, the story begins on your paper But we find the Maharam of Rutenberg leaving Germany and winding up in France. And here's where the basis of why it is I decided to cover the Maharam of Rutenberg sort of cropped up this particular year. He decides he wants to learn from the Balei Tosfos. They were the dominating force in France at that point in time. The system of study, the study under on the page of the Gemara, as opposed to what was going on in Italy at the time, which was more poetry, or off the page halacha, which was going on in Spain and North Africa with the Rambam. The Balei Tosfos were more interested in understanding the Gemara well and developing the halacha directly off the page. And they had control, says Professor Katafogel, one of the great historians who studied the Balei Tosfos. And of course, they find themselves primarily based in France. And so he winds up in France, and the primary teacher that he identifies with at this period in time is Rabbi Yechiel of Paris. Rabbi Yechiel mi Paris. He's also close with Rav Moshe of Kutzi, otherwise known as the Sar Mikutzi. And he is in France when Nicholas Donin winds up challenging in a major debate caused through the efforts of Pope Gregory. In 1236, Nicholas Donin sends a note to Gregory the Ninth. And he says that, you know, basically the Talmud is just basically one big joke book making fun of Christianity. If you study some of the Christian history a little bit, we don't have a tremendous amount in our own writings, but if you study the Christian history a little bit, you'll discover that most of the issues had to do with their ideas of how Oso Aish was born and who Mary was. And basically, they decided that it was kind of sad. So Donin writes to the Pope. And in 1239, the Pope sort of gets the message that, you know, he sends out word to all his medinos, to all his countries, that what should happen? That all Jewish books should be confiscated, specifically cartons of the Talmud. And then he causes a dispute to take place in Paris during this time of the year, 1240. The month of Tammuz. There is very little record of the debate, but supposedly Rav Moshe of Kutzi and, of course, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris must have been successful because they walked away with their lives. In fact, not too long thereafter, they emigrate to Eretz Yisrael, which we'll talk about because it plays a role in some of the Maharam's thinking himself. But, you know, the biggest problem when you win an inquisition in 1240 against the church is that when you win, you may save your life, but you lose. Who do we know that from as well? What other Jewish leader, this time not from Western Europe, who also won a massive debate? Huh? The Ramban, in his famous disputation in Barcelona, right? We know he won because he lived. But we know that it came at a cost because he lost all his rechush. Maybe another year we'll spend some time on that disputation. So anyway, what happens? In 1242, in honor of this particular debate, 24 wagon loads of Sfarim. We've been spending a lot of time downstairs cleaning and taking out books. 24 cartloads is a lot. It probably constituted almost all of the shas that existed in Europe, especially considering the fact that there was no printing press at the time. And so what happened as a result, we had handwritten copies of shas, all the handwritten copies burned. And so what happened, certainly this is the case in France and Germany, maybe even in Rome, And the Maharam of Rutenberg is watching all this. And he composes a kinna that we didn't do in the first minyan, we did in the second minyan, called Shali Srufa Ba'esh. And there's sort of a lot of hints to the episode. The most key line is in source 1a in front of you, where he declares, O tigzor l'srof das esh. What's das esh? The knowledge of fire? What's the knowledge of fire? We know what Eish Das is. What's Eish Das? What is it? It's a reference to Torah. So what's he reusing when he refers to Das Eish? It's the knowledge that was destroyed in the fire. He's using poetic license to point to Torah, Shebal Peh. V'lachein Ashri Shishalim Lach Mulayach, the Maharam of Rittenberg says, praise be the Ribbono Shel Olam, he should go back and pay you off for that which you deserve. You destroyed, oh Notre Dame. You're the one responsible, because that's where it took place. Right? Right there, in that area, in that courtyard. Right? You one day shall burn as well, the fire shall be there. Not that I'm making any reference to events of earlier this year. And then the Maharam of Rittenberg sort of packs up and he heads back to Germany not too long afterwards, probably around the year 1246. From 1246 for the next 50 years, the Maharam of Rittenberg becomes the primary decisor of Jewish law in Germany. And what was his title? Chief Rabbi of Germany? Rav of major city of Germany? He was chief cook and bottle watcher, literally. You name it, you look at the tshuvas, you try to figure it out. He becomes Rosh Yeshiva. He opens a major yeshiva. We'll see that he was unique in his yeshiva early on because his yeshiva was large and it had a dorm. In fact, in the Halachos Ketanos of the Mordechai, who was one of his Talmidim, unfortunately was murdered, Al Kiddush Hashem, he identifies some of the rules of mezuzah. Muftach anisha kol bayis shetikon kelchaso b'mezuzah. Ain't you mazik yachol ishlot bo? He says, I want you to know something. My Rebbe told me that any house that has a mezuzah properly established will never have any damage done to it. In our home, Yesh Karov Le'esrim V'Arba Mezuzahs LeBeis HaMedrash, there are more than 24 mezuzahs in the Beis Medrash itself. Just think about the number of doors you had to have in order to have 24 mezuzahs. What does that tell you about the size of the Beis Medrash? U'LeBeis HaChoref, U'LePesach HaBayis, U'LeShara Chatzera Psuach L'Rishas Sarabim. Ula Pesach Habayis HaPasuach L'Chatzar Ula Elias HaMakura Shani Ocha B'Kayetz. He says, you know, we've got a lot of doorways over there. Ula Chol HaChadorim Shal HaBachurim. And to also all the places where the boys lived. The boys must have had a dorm. This is one of the earliest times we find the yeshiva system where the boys are giving lodging. And that must be because the Maharam of Rittenberg felt content. It's a nice large home. 24 mezuzahs is serious stuff. Moved into a home. You had to purchase it, had all the mezuzah shilas. 24 is a big number. So the Maharam must have been pretty comfortable, and he's doing what he's doing, but what's his title? And the answer is he didn't have a formal title other than Rosh Yeshiva. Oh yeah. From his tshuvas, it's clear that he was the chazan. It's clear because he says, when I daven for the yomer on Pesach, I say Yotzeres, by the way. What do we see from here? Germans said Yotzeres. Why? Because the Maharam said Yotzeres. So we know. There's certain rules in Shechita that he talks about. And he says, I know that's the case. When I do a Shechita, what does that tell you? He was the town Shechit. He was the town Shechit. He was the town Rosh Yeshiva. And he was the town de facto. But he was not a formal chief rabbi, which explains a lot of things in his tshuvas. Lenny mentioned the Rashi before. Rashi has tshuvas as well. People don't think of Rashi, they think, oh, he wrote a commentary on Chas, he wrote a commentary on Chumash. And when we're growing up, we're taught Rashi, our Rebbe and friend. He's the one you go to when you're pre-art scroll, when you really want to know what's going on in the page. In fact, art scroll says, we also go to Rashi, we just give it to you in English. But when you look at Rashi's tshuvas, his responsa, most of it has to do with ritual. And the Maharam's tshuvas, in contrast, most of them have to do with Choshe Mishpat, with civil disagreements. tells you something about the difference between where each one was given an opportunity to have an impact. I'd say an overwhelming number of his tshuvas have to do with choshen mishpah, with disputations, with issues concerning taxes, with issues concerning debates between people, between dollars and dollars. And he just keeps responding. But when he responds to many of these tshuvas, he says, look, I'm not the local rabbinate, but if I was, this is the perspective that I would offer you. He's a shofet, he's a shochet, he's a chazan, he's a rosh yeshiva. He sets the tone for Ashkenazim. He specifically sets the tone for a lot of our minhagim. But none of that is because of an official title. Do you know why he had the ability to set all those tones? Why does he get the right to be identified as the one who sets the minhagim? You know the famous letter of Moshe Feinstein? Not a letter, it was an article. It's one of the few times where Moshe Feinstein appeared in the New York Times before his death. May 19th, 1974, I believe. I know, I'm pretty sure on the date because it's my brother's birthday and the year I was born. So Moshe Feinstein is interviewed by the New York Times. And one of the questions that they ask Moshe is, how did you become the chief rabbi of all the Jews? So Moshe, being the honest person that he was, he responds, I don't know. People ask me a lot of questions. I guess they like the answers, so they ask me some more questions. It's not exactly the way Pesach works, but sort of the people who become memorable because people feel that the answers that they provide are honest, because they establish a way whereby students want to learn from them and want to emulate their ways. So those are the people who become memorable for generations and generations afterwards. And so names like the Mordechai, who appears in the back of the Gemara and dies al Kiddush Hashem, is a student of the Maram of Rutenberg. And the Tashbetz, have you ever heard of that sefer? It's a very major work that identifies a lot of Ashkenazic menhagim. Sometimes you learn a commentary in the Mishnah Berurah, I'll quote the Tashbetz. Again, a Talmud of the Maram of Rutenberg, he had an influence on another commentary called the Hagos Maimonios. Have you seen it? It's in the back of the Rambam. Right? Hagos Maimonios was a Talmud of the Maram of Rutenberg. When you're influencing people who are learning Rambam, and people who are figuring out Minhag, and people who are involved in study of the Talmud, I think your name's going to stick around for a while. Not only that, he had a certain impact on Rabbeinu Asher, otherwise known as the Rush. And why is the Rush important in our world? Well, before you get to the tour, but why is the Rush important? Why is the Rush important? Those of you who studied between Minchah Ma'ariv with me when we did Klal Yehorah, we pointed out that when it came to the time of studying the Shulchan Aruch, when Rav Yosef Cairo went ahead and established the Shulchan Aruch, he used the triumvirate. Who were his big triumvirate? The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. So, you know, when you're influencing the Rush and he's part of what's going to become standardized halacha in Orthodox Judaism for years and years and years to come up to the year 5779, right, and beyond, then you kind of stick around and have a role to play. And of course, as Shabzi says, once you're getting involved with the Rush, then his son Rav Yaakov, who is known as the Bala Turin, the one who wrote the Torah, you're also going to have impact. And sure enough, Ashkenazic Jewry is very heavily influenced by this man who's sitting in his big house, which has a base medrash downstairs, and he's answering all these questions in between davening for the Amid and being a shochet and a shofet. But he's not sitting there with the official title in Germany at the time. The Maharam has a series and a particular outlook. Remember, we pointed out earlier that the Maharam had a Rebbe. The Rebbe was Rabbi Yechiel of Paris. And what happened after the great debate in Paris? Where did Rabbi Yechiel wind up? Very good, Lenny, right? Just testing to see if I can hear myself. Now that I said it, I'm sure that you heard it, I'm sure I must have mentioned it. So, of course, if your Rebbe influences you, I want to know, what did the Maharam of Rutenberg think of Eretz Yisrael? Where are his views on Zion? It's Tisha B'Av, I've got to talk about that. right? It's kind of important. Let's figure out what he says. So let me give you a sampling of his writing. Let's look at, you know, two tshuvas that appear in his writing. I'll start with the one in 3a. The one in 3 will just simply be a repeat of the one in 3a. Says he gets a shaila one day, v'sha'altem ha'av yochol ha'akev al yidei b'no la'alos l'Eretz Yisrael. The child wants to go move to Eretz Yisrael. Father says, I don't want you to move to Israel. Common situation. Child wants to say Shana Bet. The father says no. Child wants to say Shana Gimel. The father says no. You heard this one before? My dear colleague in the back is nodding his head. Yeah, I've heard it once or twice. My dear friend, you ain't heard it yet. You're going to hear it from January to June this coming year when your talmidim are crying on your shoulder at night. But Rebbe, I don't want to go. Says the Maharam of Rutenberg, you want to know what the deal is? Kiven de kaimelon de mitzvah lalos. We hold la halacha, it's a mitzvah to make aliyah. Haksiv ani Hashem. Dechol davar mitzvah lo yishmalo de kavod ha-makom kodem. If your father tells you to do something and there's a mitzvah, so avinu shava shamayim sort of trumps. Pasuk says, ishimo ve'aviv tiro. Yeah, there's a mitzvah of showing respect to a parent. But ves shapso saitish morani Hashem kuchem chayavim bichvodi. He says, okay, so now you ask the second question. V'sheshalta, isha she'ina rotza lalos. Forget about your father doesn't want you to go. What do you do when your wife says, you know, I hear in Israel it's kind of hard to get Heinz ketchup, Hellman's mayonnaise. What's the thing that they all, what's the creature comfort that they're all hoping for? Drake's cakes. Can't get their fruit pies. The apple ones are not such a big deal, but the cherry ones, man, ooh-wee. It's like a Krispy Kreme donut under the hasher of Rabbi Marcus. You know, with the gesunte ones with the cherry filling inside and the extra cavities on the outside. Yossi's not here. Don't tell him I was describing it. I haven't eaten them yet. So the bottom line is, Yossi's my dentist, doc. I'm making a comment for all dentists, but if I go to Yossi and he sees a cavity, he's going to have to give me a mussy schmooze about eating Krispy Kreme. They're sugar-free? Keys? Bikini? Oh, the lollipops. The Shema Yisrael gets the cavities. Okay. So what do you do if your wife doesn't want to go make aliyah? She's afraid. So the Maharam wrote, and he says, "Im yesh onesh yigashena kidei lachlos." Guy wants to divorce his wife. Is there something wrong if I divorce my wife because she doesn't want to make aliyah? You the shayla? So Lenny saying, Lenny, you're saying he's a little bit crazy. Why? Why? It's my dream to make aliyah. So then he says, I understand. What happened to Shalom Bias?
I think it's an unfair question.
Why?
Nowadays, aliyah is because of the comforts that people have in Kosar. Then, making aliyah was disease, making sure you get food. It was a whole different situation.
So then you'd say it would be wrong for him to divorce his wife, and today you'd say it's mutter. I'm just pointing out that's the way you do it. If I understood your comment correctly, right? No? Did I misunderstand it? Right? Let me just take the... Lenny disagrees with you, by the way. I just want to point out to you, by virtue of the fact that Lenny just wants to say, I disavow myself from Avi's comments. He's building off my comment. Not either. I don't agree. I want you to know, I get this question like literally all the time. Right? Couple comes in. Everything's perfect. They don't come in here. They're coming to see me at 2204 Morris Avenue, Suite 208, and now I've been Yotzi turning around and giving a commercial for the Center for Anxiety Relief. So sure enough, what happens? Couple comes in, everything in their lives is perfect. She's almost perfect. But I've talked about that. She wants to be like Aliyah-minded. Okay, what's the problem with that? I'm not Aliyah-minded. Or worse, I'm Aliyah-minded and she's not Aliyah-minded. Or he's not Aliyah-minded. Okay. So, what do you mean so? I said, you're kind of not thinking about Aliyah for at least 7 years based on your life plan the way you are right now. No, I know, but should I have ever thought about it, it wouldn't have worked out. I said, what does she say? She says, I've never thought about it. So the Maharam of Rittenberg is faced with this shaila in the late 1200s, early 1300s. And so the Maharam answers the person. He says, can I divorce my wife over it? Iloya onish bedavar. He says, look, if there was a punishment, loayu chachamim matirim legarsha lafkiya b'lo ksuba. Chachamim wouldn't have allowed the situation to take place. If you have a couple and one of them doesn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael, or lives in Eretz Yisrael and one doesn't want to go move to Yerushalayim, the one who doesn't want to move, yado ala tachtona, she can lose her ksuba, he can be forced to pay against his will, he can't hold her there against her will. Moving to Eretz Yisrael from a halachic perspective is a positive thing. And clearly the Maharam of Rittenberg sees this as fundamental and important. Which brings us to the obvious question. Go ahead, ask it out loud. Why didn't he go? Right? Well, before you get there, so I mentioned to you before because Lenny reminded me, Maharam of Rittenberg says he's got his Rebbe in Eretz Yisrael, right? Except that, you know what happened to a lot of the people who went to Eretz Yisrael with Rabbi Chila Paris? How big is the Rabbi Chila Paris community? I know the Ari community, and I know the Hasidish community. I know of the Talmidei Agra. How big is the Rabbi Chila Paris community in Israel? It's very, 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 very almost non-existent. Do you know why? What happened to a lot of the people who went with Rabbi Chila Paris? By the time the Maharam of Rittenberg is writing this letter, many of them have come back from Israel. And so the Maharam of Rittenberg says, So if I'm so right in my position, why do all the Gedolim say to come back? And there were many Gedolim in his time who told people, go back to Europe, you can't live there. So he says the Maharam, you should just know the land wasn't so great. You weren't wrong, Doc. At that point in time, people had no way of living a religious life. They were spending all day clearing and draining swamps. They didn't know where they were going to get their next meal from. They weren't able to establish yeshivas. So therefore, they weren't able to establish Torah mitzvahs. That's what I heard from the children. So the people have turned around, and the people understood. So when you can't keep Torah mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael, Aliyah feels. And at that point in time, a parent has the right to tell a child, come back home. But the child has to listen. It's a different story. And so if I stop and I ask you, Maharam of Rittenberg, Zionist or not Zionist? Answer? Huh? Marv? Doc? My Zionist expert? I think it's pretty clear that he's a Zionist. Right? I think he merits a blue and white cupcake on Yom HaTzmaut. Right? Because he's certainly a Chovev Tzion. So I have to go back to your question there. Right? So the question comes up over here. How come the Maharam of Rittenberg didn't make Aliyah? Do you know what the answer is? He tried. Emperor Randolph I gets appointed emperor over Germany. And the Maharam all of a sudden decides, for whatever it's worth, Rudolph I, he says to himself, if Rudolph's going to be the emperor, I can't be here anymore. There's a debate among historians as to why it was he decided he couldn't be here anymore. Whether we'll discuss, according to some people, It was after a certain period in time of intense blood libels. In 1283, 10 Jews were killed in Mayence, and in Bachrach, another 23. About a year later, 16 Jews were killed in Bruckerhausen. But in 1286, there was the killer of them all in Munich, in Germany. 180 Jews were killed in a blood libel, and the way they were killed was horrific. They were all brought to shul. And then the doors were closed and the Jews were set on fire. The shul was set on fire and the Jews were killed. So the Maharam of Rittenberg, according to those historians, they are of the opinion that he had enough. He saw anti-Semitism on the walls. He saw that nothing was being done. And so he decides he's going to run away. Professor Agis disagrees with that opinion, and he said it had to do with something a little bit more global, which may help us understand certain decisions that will happen to the Maharam. But he says he was afraid of something else. The system in Europe at the time was that the king sold local rights. So what happened was, you didn't pay taxes to the king. The king gave your rights to a lord or a series of groupies who were able to tax the regulars. And you had to pay blood money in order to make sure that you weren't beaten down. And so Agis says, the Maharam of Rittenberg and a whole bunch of others in Germany decided that there's going to be a point in time where we're not going to be able to live because we're going to be taxed for blood money, for protection, and it's not a good plan. And so whichever way it is, anti-Semitism or potential anti-Semitism, blood money, the Maharam decides in 1286 he's running away. And so he sneaks off with his children and his children-in-law, and they start heading off to go to Eretz Yisrael. And he gets as far as Lombardy. Right? Gets as far as Lombardy. And as he's in Lombardy waiting for the rest of his family or some other people who are supposed to travel with him show up, the Bishop of Basel happens to be passing through. The Bishop of Basel is a person of prominence in Europe at the time. The church has a tremendous power. And so he has an entourage. And of course, as you've seen through some of the others up until this point, the Bishop of Basel has among the people who are his groupies, Apikursin. One in particular, and this is why you have to be very careful when you use certain words around little children, one's name was Knip. Knip recognizes the Maharam of Rittenberg. And so he decides to go over to the Bishop of Basel, and he tells the Bishop of Basel, you know who that guy is? That's the leader of the Jews in Germany. And so the Bishop of Basel goes ahead to the local authorities, and he says, okay, you know, he's trying to run away. This is an insult to the crown. And on Dalet Tammuz, 1286, the local authorities in Lombardy arrest the Maharam of Rittenberg. And on Yotes Iyar in 1293, they transfer him over to the authority of Rudolf I. The Maharam of Rittenberg, from 1286 until his death, lives in prison. Two prisons in particular. There's debate among historians as to how comfortable he was in prison. Do you know why there is a debate among authorities and Jewish historians? Because they don't bother to read his writings. Because if you bothered to read the Torah writings of the Maharam of Rittenberg, you'll know exactly what he thought about being imprisoned. Oh yeah, his Talmidim were allowed to visit, and he was able to learn Torah, etc. But take a look at what he writes in Tshuvas Maimonios in 4a. He says, he's responding to a particular answer to a question. He says, Kima la'ani yodea sheyoshev choshech v'tzalmaves v'los darim ze gimel shamnem u'mechza. He says, How am I supposed to answer questions? I'm sitting here in darkness with no order, no plan for the last 3.5 years. In source 4b, he identifies there was a big issue that was coming up at the time about whether a person should be allowed to, whether the guy who's davening for the Amid is allowed to be the one who calls out Kohanim or not. And he says, so he identifies the issue in Hagos Maimonides through his Talmud. And then he turns around and he says, but look, I'm in B'Migdal in Ziegenheim. He says, I went to discuss the matter with my Rebbe, with the Maharam of Rittenberg in Migdal in Ziegenheim, which was a prison. Third to last line in source 4b. V'hoda mori rabbeinu l'dvar v'yamar lik shechazar bo min amina gahu. He says, when he was davening for the Amud, he used to say, he used to call out until he got to Kohanim. And then he realized that that was not the standard practice. And then he goes on from there, but we see certainly that he was accepting his Talmidim during this period in time. So some point out, look, if a guy's able to have his Talmidim present, how bad could the matzah be? How bad could the situation be? But others disagree and they say, wait a second, the guy's miserable. He's not happy. How good a matzah could he be in? And so we know in the end what happens to the Maharam of Wittenberg is that he dies. And when he dies in prison, you know what happens to him until the end? He's kept imprisoned. In fact, he's imprisoned for 10 more years afterwards. He's not only imprisoned then, he's imprisoned all the way through till afterwards as well. So the Shaila is brought up, does he die al-Kiddush Hashem or not? Would you consider the Maharam of Wittenberg a person who died al-Kiddush Hashem? Stayed in prison. Well, before you get there, let me ask you, from the perspective of the Maharam of Wittenberg, there must have been a lot of Kiddush Hashem stuff going on. How does he look at Kiddush Hashem? In his mind, there's no greater opportunity. Look at the Asara Arugei Malchus. Let's see what he says. Go ahead, Doc. Excellent question. Hold out. I'll get there. I've got a couple minutes. Yeah, hold on. We'll get there. If I give away everything now, then I don't have anything left, and then we're going to have to start Mincha early, and everyone else is going to get upset. So let me first introduce to you the understanding of the Maharam of Wittenberg. Despite all the krechting and the difficulties and the differentiated difficulties he feels he's suffering, he writes in the Tshuva source number 5, when a person makes a decision to die al Kiddush Hashem, listen, this is incredible. I wouldn't believe it if it didn't appear in the writings himself. There's no sense. There's no sensations. He doesn't feel it anymore. And he goes on to prove it. He says, you know, it says in Shir Hashirim, right? Mitzoni Hashomrim Ba'ir Hikuni Pitzoni. The work people came along, they beat me around. He says, but there was no, the Mefarshim explained, there was no recognition of pain. Now, if you nip your finger in the car door, something that hopefully you will not do as I have done, I'd like to point out more than once, which is kind of sad. Right? But if you have that, you feel the pain, even if it's in the smallest piece of your pinky. And here it is, that hikuni pitzaoni, it doesn't seem to affect the people. And then he goes on and he talks about Rabbi Hanina ben Trajon. Rabbi Hanina ben Trajon, who was suffering, we heard about him this morning when we talked about the Arze al-Vanon Adirei Torah. Rabbi Hanina ben Trajon, about whom Rabbi Shapiro spoke, and during the Perek on the Lawn last year, when he spoke so much about what it was that Rabbi Hanina ben Trajon went through. Well, the Maharam of Wittenberg says, you know, we don't find recorded anywhere. Once he decided that he was dying al Kiddush Hashem, it doesn't record any pain. So therefore, the Maharam of Wittenberg says, it sounds like once you make that mindfulness decision, I am giving myself over to God, Kiddush Hashem it is. The steps in between become irrelevant. Yes. We seem to see that, but Rabbi Akiva doesn't utter a pain. So you're asking wonderful questions. I don't know what the Maharam of Wittenberg was thinking. But you know what else? This is not the only tshuva that he has where he talks about Kiddush Hashem. And the other one is even more disturbing than this one. Guy writes to the Maharam, Yudi echad shal as maram sheyechia im tzorech kapara al sheshachat ishto v'dalet bana biyom hera grav bekoven ishir adamim ki kach bekshu. A guy has to go ahead. We talked this morning about yidei nashim rachmanios bishlu yaldehen, about the women who had to cook their children. So what about the person who was asked by his wife and kids, kill us? Why? He realizes his children are going to suffer terribly. So he decides, I'm going to kill them now while Kiddush Hashem, lest they suffer. And then he says, Hu ratza la'arog es atzmo b'misasamo as well. He wanted to kill himself. The only thing was, El shetzilo Hashem al yedei goyim, he wasn't killed. His neighbor saved him. So now he realizes, I've got this tremendous burden to carry because I killed my whole family. Maybe the neighbors would have saved him as well. So what type of kapara do you charge in that situation? You're the Maharam of Rutenberg. Thoughts? What do you tell somebody? I'll tell you what the Maharam did. He stops and he says, I don't know what to tell you. I certainly know one thing. That a person who gives up his life al Kiddush Hashem is not considered a murderer. A person who gives up his own life. We have that episode that appears in the Gemaras we're allowed to learn on Tisha B'Av about the woman whose children were taken away and how one after another, each one is told, Plach Lavo Dezara, bow down. And each one says, no, I'd rather give up my life. Even the youngest among them. And the Caesar says to him, look, I'm going to drop my ring. And he says, Chaval Alecha Kesar, you're so worried about your kavod. And I'm not going to worry about the kavod of Melech Malchei Amlachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Each one of those kids gave himself up for murder. How many of them are guilty? Guilty? Maram says, it's crazy. They're Kedosh Elyon. So you know what the difference is over here? Well, you're allowed to give up your own life for Kiddush Hashem. He says, I don't know from the sources that you're allowed to do the same to your wife and kids. However, and he says this in the third paragraph, Miu davarzep pashat hatera. I'm positive that it must be mutter. Source 5a. Why must it be mutter? Kishamanu umatzanu, because I found kishamanu umatzanu, that what? That people have been doing it. Kishamanu umatzanu shaharbe gedolim shayu shochtem es b'neim es b'noseim. V'gam Rabbeinu Klunimus osa kein. Rabbeinu Klunimus did it. And by the way, if you ask me who is Rabbeinu Klunimus, Marv, who is Rabbeinu Klunimus? I'll tell you who he was. No. Rabbeinu Klunimus here was somebody who was living in the period of the Rishonim. We know who he is because... Yes, but not this one. This particular Rabbeinu Klunimus, we know him because we mentioned him this morning when we recited the Kina Se'um Mimeni. There's a Kina about the Crusades. And he was there. And he had to do this himself. So he says, I think therefore such a situation is okay. Umisha matino kapara, and somebody who says that you need to be mechaper, jumping down to the two paragraphs, motzi lazal chasidim arishonim. He says such a person is asking questions and he's raising and casting aspersions on the actions of the earlier generations. You don't have a right to go ahead and do that. What an incredible life. Look at the tragedy. He starts off in tragedy. He lives a life where things grow into a height. And all he wants to do is move to Eretz Yisrael. And he's denied. And from there he sees tragedy. And he winds up in prison and he has to deal with the prison, the situation. So the doc turns around and he asks me, but why doesn't he ever bother to get ransomed? After all, that was the standard practice back then. The standard practice at the time of the Maharam was, you got taken captive, you were held for ransom, and then the people turned around, they paid the ransom, and you went free. And so why didn't the Maharam of Rutenberg allow this? Until the end of his life, until I believe it was 13 years after he died, the Maharam's body wasn't let free. Why does he allow these things to happen? So the Maharshal, Rav Shlomo Luria, debates this question in Masech Gittin. Because there, we talk about redeeming people. We talk about something called Pidyon Shvuyim. And we have a rule. that you, unless it's extreme circumstances, we never allow the redemption for more than a person's value. And so in the context of the discussion, he discusses the issue 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the sixth, end of the sixth line of source number 6. And he says, Shamati al Marami Rutenberg, Zichrono Levracha, I heard about the Maram of Rutenberg, Shaya Tafus b'migal Egzheim, Kamishanim, he was imprisoned. Vasar and Rudolf, Tava min Akilo Sach Gadol, Rudolf and demanded a lot of money. Vakilos, how you wrote some liftoso. And the kilos, the communities wanted to redeem him. Velo iniach, and he didn't give permission to go ahead and do so. Why didn't he give permission? Because he said, you're not allowed to pay too much. Says the Marshal, do you know who you are? Sometimes it's important for somebody to know who he is. And I understand he's a Talmud Chacham Muflag. He's answering all the questions all over Germany. There was nobody like him in the community at large. So what's he being such a humble person that you're not allowed to redeem, that you're not worth it? The entire world needs you. Why don't you allow it to happen? What about the bittul Torah? What about the embarrassment and the loss of Torah in the process? So the Marshal answers, "Uvadai daito aya shem yiftu oso im ken yesh lemechus shlo yasu ken koasarim l'tamid chacham amuflag shebedor." He says, "You know what will happen if we bow under these circumstances? You know what's going to happen from here on out? Terrorists are going to come through, and they're going to do it again, and they're going to do it again." And he says, I want you to know that I'm right. Because remember, I pointed out there was somebody called the Rush. How come the Rush wasn't taken captive? The answer is they wanted to, says the Marshal. The only thing was, he found out about it and he ran away. He saved his own life. So therefore, the Maram of Rutenberg decided, Mutav shetovad ma'at chachma yoseres mi Yisrael. It's better that a little bit of knowledge gets lost, Mimash Tovad Chachmas HaTorah Ikar, rather than letting the Chachmas HaTorah be lost in its entirety, because the process is just going to keep repeating itself. And I think that's a fundamental lesson for us to understand. If last year we talked about how a Jew travels in exile and still stays authentic to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then the life, the trials and the travails of the Maram of Rutenberg, from the Shali Srufa Be'esh to the trials and tribulations in Rutenberg, to the experiences of all the different issues of Kiddush Hashem, to the formulation in his head that people are giving up their lives for God, and he still remains authentic. To the person who manages to try to escape to his beloved Eretz Yisrael, knowing that life's going to be hard there, only to be taken captive and live the rest of his life in prison and continue even from prison to influence the people, but not allowing himself to be pulled out, lest Torah be lost in the process. The Maram of Rutenberg serves as a paradigm for us how to appreciate HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how to appreciate even in the darkest moments our connection, and how we can make it our business not only in death, but in life. L'kadesh Shmo Barabim. May we take the lessons that he offers us, and may we use them in our own lives, make sure that whatever and wherever we go, we create a Kiddush Hashem in the process. And Be'ezras Hashem, next year, our trips won't be away from the land of Israel, but our trips will be up to Yerushalayim. May we get there. B'mehera v'yameinu.